that there's some similarities and differences between the Pali canon, you know, the canon that is said to be from the original teachings that the Buddha gave, the original and very widely spread popular teachings, okay, turned into the Pali canon. And then the canon that was mostly in Sanskrit, that had a lot of the Mahayana sutras, and that got compiled later, but I'll talk a little bit about that later on. Anyway, there were between what later became called the Mahayana sutras and then the Pali sutras, a lot of the topics were similar in the sense that, you know, the Mahayana talked about the four foundations of mindfulness, just like the Pali canon did. It talked about the 37 harmonies with enlightenment, talked about the Eightfold Noble Path and the Four Noble Truths, talked about the four Brahma Viharas, it talked about the jhana stages of developing concentration. You know, there were all these topics that were, you know, completely in common between the Pali canon and the Sanskrit canon, or what later became the Sanskrit canon. These, right now, we're still in India, so it's the Mahayana Sutras, because the Sanskrit, the canon wasn't really, it wasn't consolidated in India at all. So you had, you know, many of the same topics, but the way they were spoken of was really different. Because, for example, in the Prajnaparamita Sutras, it would list, you know, the Four Noble Truths, Noble Eightfold Path, Four Mindfulness, 37 Harmonies of Enlightenment, all these different things. But one, and all the realms of existence, all the different classifications of phenomena that are all common, you know, in all these sutras. The Mahayana Sutras would list them and say that they're all empty of inherent existence. Okay, so then when you study the Prajnaparamita Sutras, you know, then you study the implicit meaning, which is all these different lists of things that exist, and then the explicit meaning, which is that they are all empty of inherent existence. Okay, so it talked about all these same things, but, you know, very much, at least in the Prajnaparamita Sutras, in saying that they were empty. Yeah. And then you also, so there were this commonality in the sutras and many of the topics, and, you know, the same thing about impermanence and dukkha and, you know, selflessness and all these kind of general topics were the same. The Mahayana sutras began to present a slightly different view of selflessness. Yeah, because they started to speak about the emptiness of inherent existence of all phenomena, not just the selflessness of person that was so evident in the Pali canon. This is all said from the Tibetan viewpoint. I have to add a little footnote here that, you know, I mean, having been to Thailand and heard some teachings on selflessness there and emptiness there, for me, you know, I really want to explore exactly what each tradition means when they say emptiness and selflessness. Because I think it's just too easy to say, you know, that so-and-so believes this simply because everybody in your tradition has thought that way for several, you know, many centuries. But when did they actually talk to the people from that tradition to find out what they actually believed? And what's been the development in each tradition themselves about what they believe. So I have, you know, I want to learn more a little bit about, you know, well, what is the Theravada view of emptiness exactly? You know, there's some similar words in my studies. Some things seem similar, some things seem different. But, you know, you always have to ask when people use words, what do they mean by those words? And even you get a definition, well, what are, you know, are you really understanding it correctly? I mean, words are really, and they're so vague sometimes. Anyway, so I find it quite interesting that in the early centuries, What later became, you know, this very different tradition, the Mahayana, was completely blended in with everybody else. You know, and in one monastery you would have people practicing all sorts of different sutras. The style of the sutras between the Pali Canon and the Mahayana was different. Because the Pali Canon, you could tell that it was really initially passed down orally, because there's all these ways that it's written that's really conducive for memorization. For example, there's very stock formulas about how somebody greeted the Buddha, you know, about how the monks greeted the Buddha. And there's stock formulas in many, many sutras about, you know, how the Buddha responded to certain questions. Yeah. And in fact, what I want to get to later on here is not today, but another day, is to talk about the second sutra in the Long Discourses, which talks about the fruit of the Shramana life. Yeah, it's very beautiful. And a lot of the stuff in that sutra, it's just these stock formulas about, you know, how you practice. There's nothing wrong with stock formulas. Don't think, oh, you know, it's contaminated. Not at all. But rather because I'm sure when the Buddha taught, he would talk about similar subjects to many people. Yeah, he'd always say them in different words. But when it comes to memorization and passing it down, then you kind of, you make it the same in all the different, in whenever these topics are in different sutras, because then there's a greater likelihood that they'll be memorized correctly and passed down correctly and not botched up and boggled. Okay, so you see that in the way that the Pali Sutras are written. And also the Pali Sutras, you really get a feeling for the Buddha as a human being. You know, they talk about, you know, the Buddha wakes up in the morning and he kind of looks at the world and he picks up his alms bowl and he walks, you know, so-and-so, and he talks to this king and he talks to this beggar, and you know, you really get the feeling of the Buddha as a human being. And you get a feeling of his disciples, you know, around him, these different monks and nuns and the lay benefactors and so on. You get a feeling for them as persons who interrelated in a real society. And it's very kind of inspiring. And the Buddha is depicted as a human being, certainly a quite remarkable one with extraordinary powers that, you know, surpass those of his disciples. But he was a human being, and he had a biography and a mom and dad and, you know, the whole thing. When you get into the Mahayana Sutras, everything becomes very cosmic, okay? First of all, the writing style is very different. Mahayana Sutras are much more literary works. You don't find the same thing of stock phrases that are repeated over and over again. You just don't find it, you know? And instead you find these incredible descriptions of pure lands and bodhisattvas going here and there, and the sutras are really, really long. You know, the Pali Sutras are all fairly short, you know. The Mahayana Sutra is enormous, you know, and they're talking about these various Buddhas and, you know, some bodhisattvas going across three countless, you know, zillion universes to go to this one Buddha land to talk to him, and then all these other Buddhas are coming in and manifesting and surrounded by bodhisattvas and preaching all these things, and trees made of silver and gold and beryl and sapphire and radiant here and, you know, light going there. I mean, there is just, it's really far out. Okay? It's beautiful. It's beautiful. You know, I think reading Mahayana Sutras is the best antidote to depression that could ever exist. Because you read these sutras, you know, because you know how it is when you're depressed. Your mind's so small. It's like, you know, we're just sitting there. My problem, and this is wrong, and the world's screwed up, and I feel lousy, and blah, blah, blah. You know, the mind is like so narrow, so confined when we're depressed. Well, you read a Mahayana Sutra, and there's godzillions of Pure Lands and Buddhas flying in and out, and you know, these incredible bodhisattvas that are radiating light and enlightening sentient beings and making these outlandish bodhisattva vows that completely uplift your heart and expand your mind about what the, how they're going to lead all sentient beings to enlightenment. And you know, it just goes on and on, these incredible descriptions of things. There's no way you can have a small mind and when you're reading a Mahayana Sutra. There's just no way. You know, your mind just, you know, expands into the universe. So they're very, very inspiring. Yeah. So it seems, you know, that the Mahayana Sutras kind of became more public also when writing became more prominent. Okay? So especially in those first centuries A.D., then there was a much, much higher literacy rate. So you have the appearance in the world of all these Mahayana Sutras. Of course, they're all copied out by hand. And I mean, the Pali Sutras were too. But you have so many injunctions in so many of the Mahayana Sutras saying to write them down and how much good karma you create even by writing them. Not just reciting them, but there's all this in the Mahayana Sutras, all this, and the Sangata Sutras, a good example, all this, like, for lack of a better word, propaganda or advertising about all the virtue of learning and writing this sutra. Okay, so you find that a lot in the Mahayana Sutras too. So they're really quite beautiful, and you're breathtaking and enormous, okay, but very different in the feeling you get. And then also the way they portray the Buddha, you know, the Buddha is no longer a human being, you know, with a mom and dad, but, you know, he's been enlightened for many centuries, you know, for a long time. He was waiting in Tushita heaven to appear on our earth. He has all these kind of magical abilities. Okay, so, you know, people will say, oh, they just made the Buddha from a human being into a god. But, you know, I'm not convinced that that view is right, because if you think of the nature of the mind as being clear and knowing, then it means the mind can reflect and know anything. So why can't the Buddha be omniscient? And if you're omniscient, why can't you have the ability to manifest all these other bodies? You know, if you read in the Pali scriptures, they definitely talk about supernatural powers there. You know, there's the divine eye and the divine ear, and even the regular story in the Pali Sutras about how the Buddha saw all of his previous lives, you know, and then how he saw the death and rebirth of all sentient beings. And the Buddha, you know, he still had, you know, 4 fearlessnesses and 10 powers in the Pali Sutras, but these were kind of expanded in the Mahayana Sutras. So, but if you think about it, well, why couldn't the Buddha have been omniscient? Why not? I mean, if you have that kind of purity of mind, why not? And if you're not confined to a body that's made of flesh and blood, why not, you know, be able to make all sorts of emanations? Yeah. One example they give in the Mahayana Sutras a lot is an example for emptiness about how magicians would change sticks and stones into magical horses and elephants. Well, in ancient India, if a magician could do that, and that's just an ordinary magician could make things sticks and stones appear as horses and elephants, why couldn't the Buddha, who has so many more greater realizations, make manifest bodies for the sake of sentient beings? Why not? Okay, so you definitely have a difference in the portrayal of the Buddha, you know, between the Pali Sutras and the Mahayana Sutras. Okay. Then also what you started having in the centuries AD is many more commentaries by the Indian sages. Okay. In the early, if we go back to the BC centuries, okay, you have commentaries appearing in the form of the Abhidharmas. There are a lot of monks who became Abhidharmaists, you know, which became the third basket of the teachings, the Vinaya basket, Sutra basket, and then Abhidharma basket. So there were those who were making commentaries, but they were more just extracting things and relating different lists and new numbers to each other. But then in the AD centuries, that's really when you had many more commentaries actually being written. I mean, the great Pali commentator, Buddhaghosa, you know, he was Indian, he went to Sri Lanka, and he wrote commentaries on the, you know, almost everything in the Pali canon. And then from the Mahayana side, you know, you have Nagarjuna starting it out, and he starts writing all these commentaries on the Prajnaparamita sutras. Then you have Asanga, who's writing commentaries on the, or channeling commentaries from Maitreya, which are about the third turning of the Dharma wheel, all those sutras. Then you have, you know, Bhava Viveka expanding more on what Nagarjuna wrote, or Aryadeva first did, then Bhava Viveka. But then you have, you know, the rise of all these Hindus that are starting to debate with the Buddha. So then you have Dinaga and Dharmakirti developing this system of logic in the 5th and 6th centuries. And then some of the Majjhimika writers using Dharmakirti's logic to defeat the non-Buddhists. And so, you know, the whole way Buddhism was learned starting to change, because all of a sudden you had this pushback from the Hindus and all the debating that was going on. So then they formed the big monastic universities that actually started out just as, you know, it was one monastery, and then maybe a neighboring monastery, and then pretty soon you had, you know, several thousand people living there and doing a lot of debate. Sometimes you had non-Buddhists living there. Sometimes you had lay people. Chandragoman was lay. He lived at one of the monasteries. And I recently read an article, you even had nuns at Nalanda. Yeah. So. Okay. So you had a lot going on, you know, as all this is going on. What's very curious is, you know, that the Mahayana didn't become an actual tradition until maybe, I don't know when it was, you know, when it started even becoming known as the Mahayana tradition, as a separate thing rather than just people who have different views. You know, because I'm sure at the beginning when Nagarjuna was alive, well, he just has a different view than somebody else. But it wasn't an actual tradition. So it'd be very interesting to see, you know, when did they start actually using the names Mahayana tradition? Or when the Tibetans talk about the philosophical schools, you know, when did Vasubandhu, well, he must have lived time, he and Asanga were brothers, so that was the 4th century. So Vasubandhu was a Vibhasika, you know, but where did that term come from? And it wasn't one of the 18 schools. And, you know, and Satantrika, and who invented those terms and how solidified were they? It seems that, you know, in the way the Tibetans explain the tenet system now, that, you know, everybody who's a Vivasika believes this, and everybody who's a Sutantrika believes this, and everybody who's, you know, Chittamatra believes it and that, you know. But actually, in the preceding centuries in ancient India, all these people lived together, and it wasn't even clear how much they identified themselves, you know, whether they were such strong, isolated, concrete groups that debated with each other, or it's not really even clear how much they actually agreed on certain tenets. And certainly you can see when the Tibetans explain the tenet system, they'll say, oh, well, the Vibhasikas believe in true existence, and the Vibhasikas say that the person is the collection of the aggregates. Well, not exactly. Okay, but what the Tibetans have done is they've studied what they've discerned, what they've called the Vaibhasika system, and said, well, if you believe in this, then you must believe in true existence. Mm-hmm. And if you believe in this, then you must say that the person is the collection of the aggregates. Okay, so it's not like those people actually stated that themselves, because that would be completely contradictory to the Buddha's whole doctrine of anatma. You know, of selflessness. So I'm saying this because, you know, when you study the Tibetan tenet systems, you get the feeling like there were just these four schools. Okay, some of them have different branches, but they had a leader, and everybody believed the same thing, and they had their catechism all laid out, and they, you know, and the this one was saying, yes, I believe the person is the mental consciousness, and this one saying, yes, I believe the person is the mind basis of all. But in actual fact, no. You know, it was only in Tibet when they started doing the tenet systems that they began to impute things backwards on what some of these poor people believed. You know, and especially, I mean, Baba Viveka, he gets torn apart in Tibet, you know, because he said some things, and first there was Buddha Palita, and then Baba Viveka contradicted Buddha Palita, and then Chandrakirti came and saved the show, and, you know, told Baba Viveka that he was way off. But, you know, you wonder that all the things that you know, Lama Tsongkhapa and Chandrakirti are telling Baba Viveka that he's wrong about, you wonder if Baba Viveka even believes those things, you know? Or if it's just that they're looking back on his writing and saying, well, if you said this and this and this, then you must have believed this, and we're refuting that. That's totally wrong. Okay, so the development in Tibet and the tenet system of the schools, I think, was a very skillful way of helping us try and figure out what we believe. Okay, so when I study these things, I don't take it as like completely literally, and, you know, oh God, that Gaya Sangha, you know, he just didn't know what he was talking about because it was the Chittamatra. But you know, not thinking like that, but rather when you study the tenet systems, kind of the Vibhasika is one that's kind of closest to our normal way of thinking. And then Sutantrika is a little bit further away from our normal way of thinking. And Chittamatra is a little bit further away. And Majjhimaka is really far out, you know? So if you study them in that order, because the Tibetans have systematized them that way, then kind of gradually your own mind begins to expand in terms of what you can understand. And when you see the debates about what the upper schools said to the ones below them about, you know, how their tenets were wrong, then you could begin to understand that and say, oh yeah, you know, I believed it. When I first read that the Vaibhasika said that made a lot of sense, you know, that seemed really good. But yeah, now I'm studying Sutantrika, I can really see how maybe the Vaibhasikas are wrong and Sutantrikas knew better what they were talking about. You know? And so then you kind of adopt a Tantrika view for a while. Then you study Chittamatra and you go, yeah, well, the Chittamatra told us, the Tantrikas, that they were way off about this whole business about partless atoms. And yeah, that makes a lot more sense. And so you can see the development of your own mind, how you become more and more capable of understanding broader and broader concepts, you know? So I think that's one reason for teaching it in that way. And then another reason I think for teaching it is that, well, you know, when you finally get to Prasangika Majjhimika, to really understand what they mean by the emptiness of inherent existence, it's like if you study the lower schools somewhat, then you have a much better idea exactly of what's getting refuted. Whereas if you just go right to the Prasangika when you study, sometimes it seems so obvious Well, why would anybody believe otherwise? But it's only when you've gone through that step-by-step thing that you begin to get a better idea of how your own mind grasps it in here in existence. Just like the people in those lower tenets schools did. Okay? I hope some of this is making sense to you. Okay? So then I think, you know, it really does help you as you're learning it, because it makes you understand your own self-grasping a lot better.